Hi, my name's Julie Macken and welcome to More Civil Societies. When I was little, I think, about 4 years old, me and my little brother, who's about 2.5, were bored out of our minds one day and our gorgeous grandmother was trying to round us up to have an afternoon nap. Her and I were standing at the end of what felt like a very long corridor when I saw my little brother come crawling around the corner, straight down the corridor toward the front door. He was crawling along, by the way, he could walk. I don't know why he was crawling. But anyway, he was crawling along with his eyes tightly shut. As he bounced off walls, into tables, into chairs, he just kept those eyes really tightly shut. Until he crawled straight into my grandma's legs, where he just kind of froze. At that point, I asked him and said, "Why have you got your eyes shut?" And he said, still with his eyes shut, "Because I can't see you and you can't see me." I was reminded of that the other day when I read a really compelling and terrifying piece by Jeff Sparrow in the online journal Eureka Street. He began the piece with this quote: "There's no conservatism without nature. There's no nationalism without environmentalism." And if that sounds kind of like the logic of a progressive environmentalist, it's not. It was part of a manifesto by one of the racist murderers that wrought so much damage earlier this year. I really recommend everyone read Sparrow's piece. Just Google it under its headline, "El Paso Shooting and the Rise of Eco-Fascism." In it, Sparrow raises the spectre that in the absence of serious and effective and collective action on climate change, action that would avert the catastrophe of a world over 2 degrees hotter, eco-fascism could rise to fill the vacuum left by inaction and inanity. Unlike many who use the term fascist as a kind of universal insult to describe everyone they don't like, Sparrow uses the term very precisely, saying, "Fascism distinguishes itself from other political tendencies by its commitment to redemptive violence. Fascists seek the physical extermination of those committed to social equality, labour movement activists, socialists, social democrats, immigrants, and others they deem traitors. They valorise the supposedly natural differences between individuals, between men and women, between ethnic or racial groups. The fascist programme generally calls for some kind of violent nationalist revolution to purge the nation and restore an organic hierarchy. To that end, they draw upon whatever national myths or ideologies they can scrabble together with any necessary coherence." That's from Sparrow. Of course, much has already been written about Hitler the conservationist, about the deployment of myth in the rise of Nazi Germany, the slogan of a desire for blood and soil that so closely linked the people with the land, that sought to elevate a kind of racial purity to nature, and what the fascists call the natural order, an order that valorised the wild places as places of purity and the towns and cities and their inhabitants as deviant and perverted. A lot of people have argued that as the impact of global warming intensifies with food and water shortages, the forced movement of entire communities as people flee drought, famine and the wars that follow so closely on the heels of those scourges, people will be looking for who to blame and how to make sense of these crises. And this is where eco-fascists could potentially find an opening. After all, even in polite conversation, when people are talking about drought and water restrictions and the like, often the first thing discussed is the carrying capacity of country. And frankly, this is a discussion that needs to be had with a really close look at patterns of consumption primarily, not just numbers of people. Because obviously, as we Australians continue to prove to the world, you can have a massive country with a tiny population of 25 million and still consume more than anyone else on the planet. But I digress. This kind of discussion can lend itself well to the fascist agenda of who gets to have country. Who should be eliminated to make room for the chosen people? Sparrow answers that question in his article, saying, "The Christchurch and El Paso murderers had no problem in providing an answer. Both of them blamed immigrants and set out to kill them." Look, this is not to talk up the power or relevance of fascists. They're weak and tiny. Indeed, Their recourse to violence underscores their inability to make an argument or build a political constituency for their ideas. But it does raise two issues for me. Well, it raises numerous issues, actually. The first is the need to show zero tolerance for climate remedies that scapegoat ordinary and often powerless people. And this is a call out to all those in the environment movement. As Sparrow says in his conclusion, the more we can unite social and environmental justice in a program of hope, the greater the difficulty for fascists seeking a hearing. I love that ending from him. But my second issue is, for me, it takes me back to my little brother as he held his eyes tightly shut in the belief that if he couldn't see me, I couldn't see him. If we try to deal with global warming by shutting our eyes to the obvious dangers of inaction, and that's just not environmental and economic dangers, but primarily and powerfully cultural and political dangers, we are going to end up hurting ourselves very badly. There is a moral imperative to take action to prevent the temperature rising, and part of that moral response is to recognise that there is no such thing as a political vacuum in these circumstances. We are either filling the space with action, inclusion, reciprocity, and hope, or it will be filled with violence and control. Right now, we have a choice, and it depends on us opening our eyes to our own capacity for destruction, our own capacity to see things go terribly wrong.